Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
This is Spin the Rally Pod, your regular update of rally news and views from our panel of experts. I'm just the fan, Lisa O'Sullivan, but the gang's all here this week. Dirtfish senior staff writer David Evans, former motorsport sporting director George Donaldson, and Dirtfish's very own voice of rally, Colin Clark.
And let's not do any more messing around, because it is the voice of rally that we need to talk to first, because Colin, you have been watching rally cars go through a Finnish forest.
Can you feel the daggers, Colin?
I feel honoured and privileged that I'm being invited to talk first. But you're quite right. You know, it was quite a remarkable week. One or two suggestions that, well, it was just another test week. Was it heck? You know, it was the first time we'd seen World Rally Cars back on gravel stages in over 3 months. And we had five of the top drivers in the world. Our M Sport drivers clearly weren't there. But at least it was a fantastic week. And it was just great to see the cars, to hear them, to feel that actually there was some sort of normality there, that there were plans being put in place and that there was light at the end of the tunnel. And it was a very, very positive week.
You must have all been giddy.
Yeah. You know what? It was one of those weeks where...
He's always giddy, Lise.
He's a giddy guy.
Giddy's a good word. I like that word. Terribly English word, but I do like it. I'm feeling jolly giddy this morning.
More importantly, as well as the cars, did you see the Lupin's goal?
Oh, goodness me. I meant to mention that. So normally we go to Finland in late July, don't we? And there are some beautiful wild flowers in the meadows. And particularly, where's that hairpin right, David, where, remember, Craig Breen had a massive crash. That's the one. So there's a hairpin right there. That field is full, that meadow is full of beautiful flowers in July. But what we had this week were the lupins. And I said to Heikki, our cameraman who I was with, I said, my God, they're absolutely beautiful. He went, no, they are weeds. I went, yeah, but they're... they're beautiful weeds. They're absolutely... And you know what? It's like in... Georgie, you know in Scotland when you come into Dundee in springtime, about 20, 30 years ago, they spent a fortune planting daffodils. And it's a beautiful, it's a sea of yellow as you come into Dundee on the main arteries. It's like that on the roads around you. Vascular, these beautiful purples and deep, deep purples, lighter colour purples, pinks almost, and whites. Oh. The lupins were gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
Thank you. Thank you, people, for tuning into Gardening Today.
You're on Radio 4.
You started it.
I did, that's true.
Colin, you're about to be revoked, Colin. Get on with it. Get on with our rally stuff, please.
Am I making too much of my top billing?
Yes.
sorry. Well, yeah, but as I say, I mean, for me, the most important thing was the positivity that came out of it. But it was also good to talk to the drivers and to see how they were feeling. And, it was important that they all got back in the car, although you have to say Tanak had been in, obviously, the R5 car. Nuvilla had that disastrous half-day testing, hadn't he? So perhaps last week was most important for Nuvilla. But I'd argue, actually, last week was most important for Hyundai. You know, Toyota were quite literally blowing the cobwebs away. Mm. That's what they were doing. And their drivers looked great. The car looked great. Ogier, remember his first time on fast gravel in that car. But you could argue that maybe Mexico is fast-ish gravel, but you've got the obvious problems with the altitude. But his first time on Finnish gravel, and he was absolutely gushing. And he was basically saying, I understand now why this car's been so dominant here.
And I would actually urge anyone who hasn't listened to the last Spin the Rally Pod that went out to go back and tune in to hear from Ogier, from Elvin Evans. We've got Thierry Neuville in there. We got a nice chat with Tommy Mäkinen. And of course, our current reigning world champion, Wout Tänak as well. So that's all on the dirtfish.com website to listen back to. David, how important is it that we have seen these two teams go out and test at this point?
It's vitally important, Lise, but I think, you know, what it's also worth remembering and talking about is the opportunity that came, how this test came about. There was obviously a testing ban until the end of May, and then there was an agreement that they would review the testing regulations at World Council on the 19th of June, and we would get fresh regulations for the rest of the year, because obviously the 42 days, they couldn't suddenly just use all of those 42 days in the second half of the season, so there had to be a new rule coming out. In the interim, between June the 1st and June the 19th, the teams and the FIA got together and agreed that they would allow, firstly, it was 3 days, 1 day per driver, and then the teams, I can't remember who it was, that pushed for 4 days, and I think it was Hyundai pushed for 4 days, so they, in the end, they went for the 4 days. And it was essentially a free four-day test because it came before the World Council decision. That decision has now stated that each European round will get, each driver will get 1 day testing prior to every European round. Where that leaves us for, this is a brief aside, but where that leaves us for Japan, nobody really knows. So we're still working through that. We're still trying to work out, obviously they'll need a test before Japan, but we can't test in Japan, but where do you test? Anyway, so yeah, it was vital that they got that running. And for me, it was quite interesting that M Sport didn't take advantage of that free 4 days at all. You know, they did. Obviously, there are financial implications for going testing. And it's George, you'd know better than anybody. It is not cheap, is it? You know, you run the car hard. There's rebuild costs. There's the road costs. There's all sorts of.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at, in broad terms, you're probably looking at the better part of maybe six figures a day.
Wow.
You know, it can be as much as that. I mean, if you're doing good hard testing, not to mention all the development costs, because you'll be running development parts, there'll be parts specially made and developed. Yeah, I would put up high end. I mean, if you're just going for a straightforward test, it would be considerably less, you know, just a driver setup test would be nice and much cheaper, but so the cost can vary greatly. But a proper development test,
which is what we had, George, with Hyundai. Well,
I think
with that aero, there was some new bits on there.
But this is where the Hyundai test was so important, David. And bearing in mind this subsequent regulation about 1 day test per rally, because your tests between now and the end of the year will be set up tests for the rally. But Hyundai needed that time because we know from past experience that the Hyundai has underperformed on fast gravel roads. The car's been unstable. It's not turned in well. You know, Mickelson said that again this week. He made a slightly snide comment, didn't he, in saying, you know, give me a car that turns in and I'll give you performances and I'll give you podiums and victories. You know, but it's been clearly an Achilles heel for that Hyundai. So, you know, 4 days of testing, at least two of which were proper development testing to try and get you know, that handling sorted out. And we saw new winglets on the front. We saw new design on the rear pods, on the aero pods for the Hyundai. So enormously important for them last week.
But also, you know, let's not forget, okay, we don't have Finland. But at the time of that test, it was a very real possibility we were going to have Latvia and Estonia, both of which are high-speed gravel rallies. Okay, not the same jumps and stuff that you'd get in Finland. But the development work that you would do with aero and stuff, and some setup in Finland would absolutely carry over into Latvia and Estonia. Now, the surface, you know, I don't know the surface in Latvia, but the surface in Estonia is a little bit softer. It's not, you know, a like for like, but we have seen in the past plenty of teams go testing in Estonia for Finland. So, you know, it's going to work the other way around.
Yeah, totally, totally. George, with these development tests, so, you know, we saw them with new front end and we saw them with new rear aero. Obviously that aero is developed in the air tunnels by the engineers. You know, how often will you go to a test like that and go, no, this doesn't work, and throw it away?
Well, I think you always do back-to-backs very, 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 very carefully, and you probably also go with some options. And when it comes to aero is, whilst they do spend a lot of money in the wind tunnel and they spend a lot of money on finite element analysis, ultimately, Aero's a bit of a black art, a little bit down to feel. So, you know, sometimes doing simple things like just attaching a little gurney flap on the back of your spoiler just to verify that, you know, that makes it worse or better. It is a good little test. So they'll be playing around with all sorts of things. But yeah, quite often they'll put aero on and it won't yield the result they want. A tiny little modification, a little pair of winglets out on the edge of something, as we can see on the Formula One cars. It's elaborate to the point of being like a bloody Christmas tree, isn't it, really? I mean, some of the stuff they've got, it's bizarre. It's all science. It's all facts and figures, but it's so hard to calculate it. And sometimes it just comes down to, what happens if we just do this? Boomf, massive difference in downforce, massive difference in getting a balance in the car from a tiny, tiny little modification. So you'd like to think that whilst to get the aero done, sure, in the wind tunnel, sure, it'll be done in finite element analysis. Always a tricky one for me to say that. so it seems. I think ultimately you've got to be so careful not to miss a little trick. I don't know whether the teams actually have any specific aero engineer to go out and do those last little tricky things. Could be a lot to be won there.
We saw, though, didn't we? I mean, you talk about the extremities of aero, George, and do you remember? I'm just trying to think where it was. Was it Spain or somewhere they tested? Ogier tested the new Citroën, and of course Lappi tested it as well. And we have never seen as much aero on a current generation world car. It was bonkers. There was, you know, there were wings everywhere, all across the front. It was completely different.
Yeah. They would have done that, a lot of that in the wind tunnel, but you know, the wind tunnel, depending on the one they use, was, it would be a rolling road wind tunnel, you would imagine. So you've got the road turning underneath the car,
which you absolutely need, don't you? I mean, that's,
you kind of do. Fine. Then if it's a really clever one, you can actually turn the rollers a little bit to the side, which is really, really important for a rally car. You know, so you could actually effectively have the wind coming into the car from maybe 3 or 4 degrees, 5 or 6 degrees angle, because the rally cars are very rarely just going completely in a straight line. Even when they're driven on asphalt as straight as they can be, they're still, you know, you can still very visibly in all our fantastic video that we see, they're quite clearly still drifting quite sideways. And these are massive factors. I'm not sure how many rolling roads there are like that. I mean, I know Toyota have one. I think they've got two in Cologne, actually, that can cant sideways and do full speed at, I mean, they can do something like, I'm sure they can do about 300 kilometres at full scale.
Wow. Crikey.
But do you remember, I don't know, I'm sure you were probably at Subaru when you remember the fins that came on the rear wing, George, for the first time, which would have been early 2000s, and you know, we complete noddies like Colin and I sort of looked there and thought,
I remember asking George about why they were in 2002, George. I remember asking you about those, and I remember you giving me an explanation and you saying, that is top secret, Colin, you can tell no one. And I
can
told
you tell
no
us
one
now,
since.
Then?
It was all to do with lateral movement and keeping the rear down when the car was moving sideways.
Colin, I'm now going to prepare myself. I was being completely dishonest. I mean, they were probably designed from a Kellogg's packet in the canteen, which was a porta cabin out the back.
I felt so privileged, George. I felt so privileged to be let in on your top secret engineering developments. No.
But we saw them everywhere, didn't we? You know, they were then onto the 206, and they've become part and parcel, really. Ever since.
To be honest, I can't remember the story, but I do remember David Lapworth sharing, as he did with all these things, shared some of the information about it. I can't remember the specifics. I'm not sure how much we must have done some wind tunnel modelling. It was maybe all finite element analysis on that one, I'm not sure, but it yielded a result without a doubt. Everybody followed.
Yeah.
So, David, have you heard anything in terms of feedback from the Hyundai test? Because I'll tell you what I think, and see whether or not you agree with me. You know, we talked to Oit Tanak, and we talked to Oit Tanak halfway through the second day. Now, Tanak is not a man who easily hides his emotions. If he's annoyed, if he's pissed off, you know it. And I would have to say, Tanak was as relaxed, as easygoing, as chipper as I've seen him in a very long time. Now, it's maybe quite a big leap to say, well, that suggests then he was happy with the way the test was going. What I do know, if he wasn't happy, he would have reluctantly talked to us. He wouldn't have been in that frame of mind. So my take from that is that perhaps they made progress, and perhaps that car with Tanak behind the wheel actually wasn't as bad as we've seen it in the past in Finland.
No, well, all these things are relative, aren't they, Col? You know, I mean, it's not a bad car. We saw Thierry at times in Finland and, you know, go all the way back. We saw Hayden Padden set some very good times in Hyundai. So it's not that bad. What you need a lot of in Finland, and this is something we've talked about an awful lot on this podcast, is confidence in Finland. And they, you know, Hyundai hasn't really had a driver. Okay, we saw Craig Breen doing brilliant stuff last year, but we've never had a driver that's been able to get in there and say, I'm going to win with this car. And that's, you know, that's where Tanak's mentality is right now. You know, nothing stands in his way. Nobody's quicker than him. And that would bring a degree of confidence and perhaps a tenth of a second in a corner. And so he, you know, they would have back-to-back the stage and everything, and they'd know exactly where they were time-wise. And Tanak will make that time up himself. Talking to the team and to Adamo, they're adamant that they have made a step forward with the aero and in other areas in the car. So definitely the car's gone forward. Tanak would have had the speed in himself to put that car right at the front. And if we had been going to Finland this year, he would undoubtedly have been, you know, in the race for a third straight win there. But you know, what we've also got to remember is that these guys are actually just really happy to get back in the car. You know, they've spent 3 months longer than they've ever spent in their careers, out of cars. And talking to Tanak around the test before and after, you're quite right, Col. You know, he's very relaxed. He'd done those 2 days in the R5 car. And he was just pleased to be driving again.
It's interesting.
Speaking of which, moving on, driving again, I'm kind of a bit confused because I've been reading, well, obviously dirtfish.com is my rally Bible, but I'm still not entirely sure where we're at with the rest of the calendar. I'm just kind of shuffling it on again. When will we see Tanak drive again? When are we going to see something resembling? When potentially, I know everything's still not rubber stamped, but where are we at with the calendar?
What a... The calendar is, are we allowed to say the C word? I think the calendar is rapidly becoming a whole new C word. It's, you know, it seems to evolve on a daily basis, almost on an hourly basis. You know, from what I was told, Latvia wasn't happening because it was too early in the season. August, people didn't want to be back in action then. Slightly curious argument for that. And then suddenly there was a chance that Ypres couldn't run because Turkey was too close. So if Turkey couldn't move forward, Ypres couldn't run. So then Latvia, actually, we did need Latvia. So Latvia was back on the table. And then earlier this week, so if you're listening on Tuesday last week, we had the news that Latvia was finished. So yeah, it's changing rapidly. I think there's a few, if we can say anything is certain at the moment, which we really can't, early September, we will have Rally Estonia. And it will be epic. So we're super excited about that. Using a great American term, we're super excited to be going to... we're stoked, indeed.
That's Australian,
surely.
Thank you
for that, Ken. Is it? No, that's Ken for me, isn't it?
Is it? Okay.
Ken's always stoked. It's always Ken. Yeah.
Okay.
But you're right. I think I did hear that on Neighbours a lot of years
ago.
Yeah,
that's where I was getting my cultural references.
I'm only delighted. I'm sorry.
Well done, George.
I'm a tad giddy.
Too much, Lisa. Too much.
It is good news, though, David. You're absolutely right. It's good news that we're moving towards some certainty in terms of, you know, Rally Estonia. So,
but just to skip past the rest of that, Colt. So then we look at Estonia, and then we would be looking Turkey, Ypres, Germany, Sardinia, Japan.
How many
now,
is that?
Tell.
Nine. Right.
Which is more than enough. And it has to be because there's a big question mark now over Germany, with this spike in COVID cases. And there, you know, undoubtedly there will be question marks over other events. Japanese Grand Prix was cancelled. So that cast, does that cast doubt over the Rally Japan? You would have to absolutely hope not.
Same region, David.
It is. And ultimately, George, you know, we don't know when this second wave is coming, or if it's coming even. That was, you know, part of the reason that Latvia made a lot of sense. It was in August. It was a little bit earlier. You know, we're very heavily loading the sort of September, October, November time, when if a second wave does come, you know, it could crucify it. Whereas if we'd run Latvia, Estonia, and then, you know, Turkey, Ypres, we'd have had four rounds.
And that's the championship. The
sort of middle to end of September. Exactly, Cole. It's, you know, you have to have absolute sympathy for the promoter here, because the job that they're doing, you know, they are desperately trying to sort of put a pin in something that just won't stop moving.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I think we're, you know, quick to criticize the promoter. Some of us are, particularly. but we have to give them credit where it's due. And I think they are working hard at the calendar. And I think they are being flexible in trying to put something together. But more than that, David, this news this week about a potential testing event in George, you and I, it's one of our favourite places in Greece. You know, I think that's you have talked a lot about people having to look outside the box and to be creative and to be innovative and to just look at things differently. I think this is really quite interesting to create a testing event that has marketing value. It's got value for spectators. It's just got a lot of attractive elements to it. And I think they have to be applauded for going down that route.
100%. You know, you look at Formula One testing, the way that they do that now at Barcelona in February, and they have these set tests that become events and occasions of their own. And it's always baffled me that, you know, teams have gone off and spent, as George said, you know, an awful lot of money on testing. Why not bring it all together and make an event and an occasion out of that? And that's exactly what the promoter's done. You know, someone, Richard Milner from M Sport, I know that he's been a key part in the development of this plan. And he absolutely also should be applauded for actually just applying common sense. That, you know, we all want to test for a certain event. So let's combine our force, our funds and our budgets and put it together and then actually make something of it. You know, the teams will get development and pre-event setup and all of that. But the promoter will get this 30-minute chat show at the end of every day. There's potential, you know, we could see Sebastian Ogier on a jet ski and just loads of stuff that we can do.
Going through the Corinth Canal on a jet ski, that would be quite entertaining. With George Donaldson bungee jumping from the bridge and plucking his cap from his head as he goes underneath, something like that.
That's exactly what we're after. But, you know, Cole, but the flip side
I have an immaculate sense of timing, David. I'm up for that. I want you to know.
But the flip side of that is that, you know, each one of these three teams go off and test in private. You know, we're lucky if we get a handful of pictures from it, and, you know, a bunch of lads spectators stood at the side of the road filming with their iPhones. It's pretty pathetic when, you know, we have this this ability and this option to combine it all and make a superb event. So good on
my dog's agreeing with you entirely. You can hear it downstairs barking away. But David, I think we showed last week from Finland as well that there is a lot of scope for turning a test week into a media event. You know, we made our little videos from each day of the test. We did our interviews and there was massive interest in it. So, you know, on a smaller scale, it's been tried and tested and it works. So it makes a huge amount of sense.
It does, but, you know, it will be difficult. And George, you would know about this. You know, we've all been to a test and, you know, access to the car is very, very much limited. And, you know, the drivers, the team principals, the technical people, they don't want to tell you what they're doing. And this is one of the primary concerns with some of the teams, is that they're all in one area, then, you know, they're showing their hand perhaps quicker in the flesh than they would ordinarily.
Yeah, I mean, I think an event test, a joint event test is absolutely fine. There is, you know, if you were an underinvested team and you're going along to one of these tests and you're seeing what everyone else is doing, you're gonna pick up tips, and that's not, you know, that's not what, you know, Adamo, Tommy Mackin and Malcolm Wilson are not in the business of giving away their intellectual property for free to anyone and damn the consequences. But an event test, you know, I mean, for a period of about like fully 10, 12 years, the PWRC, and then it became, you know, S2000 PWRC, and then finally WRC2, ran with a joint event test, which was unbelievably economical initially. Finally, but, I think it became commercialised, but initially it was just done at cost.
But don't forget, George, right now, event test, that's all we have. We don't have any, you know, this year there are no development tests. There is nothing. You know, you don't have your budget of days that you can go off and do some engine work over there. Yeah. You've got, for if we have Estonia, the teams will have 3 days, and that's it. So they've got to do any development towards a 2021 car has to be done within those pre-event tests.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly that's obviously, you know, going to be a huge factor. And I think the teams will ultimately accept whatever they're given, whatever constraints they're given. And I mean, honestly, in the current circumstance, I would actually 100% applaud the move for it, because it makes sense. I mean, the teams come with their garages, and also, you know, you sometimes see in service parks on rallies when there's lots of stuff going on, you'll see Hyundai will have people across looking at the Toyota service.
Well, of course, Toyota it's will natural, have
people
it?
Across look. Yeah, so you can go to the test and they can say, right, guys, none of that nonsense here. Thanks very much.
Or maybe
just keep aside, and you can go out and watch your car on the stages, and that's it. Behave yourself. Otherwise, tell you what we'll do, we'll send you home. There you go. Sorts that one out.
Quick question, David. You mentioned there development testing for 2021. You know, this 1 day test per event is clearly all about cost savings, because as we've talked about many times in the past, you know, the environment that we re-emerge into, the landscape we re-emerge into is going to be completely different, and money budgets are going to be tight. Would it not have made sense just to put a hold on development for 2021 with completely new cars coming in 2022? Why didn't they just say, that's it, these cars, well, it is what it is?
There is, you know, the cars, there's no homologation changes at all for next year. So, you know, any evolutions in the car, it's at the team's own kind of investigation and decision to do that. You know, there's nothing changing with the regs that says the teams have to change the rear wing or the fuel injection system or anything like that. The big question for me is, what does the FIA do next year with testing when, through 2021, we need pre-event tests. Obviously, you know, you need that day to get the car set up, but also we do need quite a lot of development testing for
huge amounts.
The biggest technical change that we've had in years, coming to the championship for 2022. So we wait. I kind of thought we'd have some news from that, and certainly the teams will have. I'm sure they'll go back to their 42-day allocation for 2021, but we'll need to see more space. You know, you look at Toyota this year, they tried to develop a brand new car for 2021, the GR Yaris, and they were doing it in between runs on a pre-event test. So in Sweden, the drivers would come and do their pre-event test, and when the car came in for, say, a new set of dampers or a gearbox change or something, Juho Hänninen was going out and using the same road to develop the 2021 car. That's not a particularly efficient way of testing. It's good because it gives you immediate data on where the car is in terms of the car it's superseding. But it's no way to develop a completely new car, is it, George? I mean, they will need, you know, to bring a battery into it and, you know, a different powertrain and everything. They'll need absolutely bespoke and dedicated days.
It's a huge, huge task. It's a brand new car. What can I say? It is. I mean, it, you know, with all its, you know, 10,000 individually designed parts. You know, it's a massive task. Massive. It's just you can't put it's such a huge task, and you know you do need to develop it. I mean, crikey! Ideally, you want a full year of development out of the championship to develop that car. You know, that's the advantage of a new team coming in. They've got that. They can, you know, before they've announced they've joined, they're free to to do a whole load more.
And that's the point, you know. We know that a hybrid system, the battery, everything will work, you know, in a fairly routine environment. But how's it going to be at 2,500 meters in Mexico? Or how's it going to be, absolutely, you know, if we get a proper winter in Sweden at minus 30?
David, the cars we've got just now, David, are, you know, they're complex, that's for sure. But, you know, we went to Mexico for the first time with the new generation World Rally car, and they all fell down because of the heat. And those are systems which were not a massive evolution from the previous systems. They really weren't. You know, we're bringing in this entirely new concept. And you're right, you know, the previous cars hadn't been tested at altitude before we saw them going to Mexico. You're going to have to test these new cars in extremes of temperature, plus 40 degrees potentially, minus 20, 30 degrees, altitude up to 2,000 plus meters. All of that, you know, if we're going to do it properly, has to be factored in. If they don't do it properly, well, then they have to expect real issues when we get into 2022. But, you know, if you want to do it properly, you've got to be talking 100 days of testing, not 40 days of testing.
I think, you know, the one thing that we can say is that, you know, the FIA is more aware of this, more keenly aware. The technical department knows exactly what it's about, and I'm sure that they will run a fairly kind of mild hybrid system that, you know, it'll be all quite conservative. And don't forget, you know, the thing's only got to power the car for, I think, is it 5 miles or something like that? You know, it's not far. Yeah, it's not a huge ask. But equally, at the same time, you're still mating a battery to a car that, you know, is very highly strung at the best of times. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. That, for me, is one of the big big bits of news to come out of the second half of the season, is how will testing work for next year.
So, I mean, you know, Colin, as you've said there, like, they don't need 20 days to rebuild the car. They need 100 days. Yeah, on a development test car, you know, maybe costing somewhere between 50 and 100,000 euros a day. Who's going to have those budgets?
Rocky.
5 to 10 million.
You know, we're now. I hate to harp on about this. I'll say it just once. You know, we're now into, you know, every single company that exists that I talk to are shedding people. Honestly, how can we forge ahead with this unbelievably expensive, fabulous car in a world that seems to be very obviously changed? Maybe I'm missing a trick. Maybe
I'm entirely with you.
I'm just very confused. All that money to produce a car with a 5 kilometer capacity hybrid system. Honestly, someone needs to get a grip.
I think that we are now, you know, I think we are absolutely too far down the road, and I don't think it will change from what I can see. Despite everybody's talk about Rally 2 cars, it can't change. You know, talking to the manufacturers, they've all put half a year, two thirds of a year of development into this. So I think
put 2 years into Group S.
Yeah.
Four different prototypes.
But that was a regulation change, wasn't it? And this regulation is not going to change from what I can
understand. That's what we should be looking at now, I think. Anyway.
Down the road, David, or too set in our ways with the people making decisions. I'm not sure which one it is. I'm not sure which one it is, to be honest with you. I agree entirely with George. I would like to know what considerations we have taken as a sport to address the fact that things are going to be very different when we come out of this. I would like to know. And as I see it right now, not a lot.
In those last 3 months, you know, it's quite a big ask to go through all of that regulation to get it all changed because of the current situation that we're in.
David, what do we do? I don't buy that. I really don't buy that. You know, what we've seen in this country around the world over the past 3 or 4 months is, you know, things that people thought were impossible, actually, it's not impossible. You know, to produce a ventilator, a brand new ventilator. You go and speak to David Richards at ProDrive. They came up with a fabulous new ventilator in weeks, put it into production in a matter of months. These things were considered impossible. You know, if there is an underlying need to get something done, then it will be done. The problem is that the desire and the need really isn't there from those making the decisions.
You know, I've got to say that the cost of producing an R5, what was called an R5 or a Rally 2 car, into a 2022 world car, from what I'm told, the development costs would be huge. They would be, because, you know, we've got all of the new safety cell coming in, which is vital. You know, we need that.
Totally.
And it's we need this space frame regulation, this technology to allow us to scale cars. We can't do that with a Rally 2 car. You know, that's the ability to bring in new manufacturers. For a manufacturer that's only got, say, an SUV or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, they need that ability to come in and say, right, we can scale it down, we can make it out of a tubular chassis, and here we go. We cannot do that, you know, if we stick with Rally 2 regulations.
Fundamentally,
Cole, hang on a second. Yeah. We talked about million-euro cars. These cars will be €500,000. That's what I'm told. That, to me, is a huge amount of money right now, but it's not €1 million. And I think that the private driver, there are going to be private teams out there that can make that car work and that can bring that car into the championship. It's not going to be as easy as if it was a €200,000, €200,000, €250,000 car. But that car, from what I'm told, you know, and George will know an awful lot more about this than me, it's not possible. You cannot make that car for 2022 to that price. You can't put the hybrid into it. You can, of course, physically, but you can't make the car. So, you know, we're arguing a kind of moot point here, because it's the economics of it are working in favour of sticking with what we've got.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, okay. I mean, look, David. I mean, it's a sound argument, and I get the scaling idea. But are we actually going to bring manufacturers in?
That's my point.
Committed
but,
to it?
But okay, we're certainly, I mean, not if we stick, if, you know, if we go back to Rally 2. Mm. You know, right now, that's a barrier to entry. You know, right now, it's a big barrier to entry to Toyota. We know that Toyota can build an R2, a Rally 5, a Rally 2 car. God,
I was wondering what you're on about there.
R5.
Rally 2, R5, yeah. Whatever it is.
Yeah. We must move forward. We must get with the times. It's Rally 1 is a World Rally car. Rally 2 is an R5 car, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. So Toyota could build that car. Of course they could. Mm. But right now, they don't have one. So, you know, it is
most manufacturers have small cars, David, and that seems to have been the way that I suspect it's the competition companies have driven us down to this, you know, this small category of car.
But George, if you were going to build a brand new car, would you rather A, have the ability to scale and build a space frame chassis, or B, take a compromised production road car that is sitting there?
I think every time, I mean, the engineer in me, as much as there is, would say space framed car. But the essence of rallying is that we're on highways and byways, homologating or modifying a road car in a lot of countries is a permissible action. In some countries, it's not, but there's always a buy in it. How are you going to get these space framed chassis registered for road use? I would question that to start with. I mean, in Britain you can do it, but can you do that in Germany? Well, I think Germany, they find that you absolutely can't do it in Germany, but they find ways around the rules. They're very, very good at doing that. But the other thing is, we've had space-framed cars before in Rally. Yeah, they were called Group B. I know that safety's moved on a lot, but I'm just
safety's
still not buying it. I'm still not buying it, David.
Safety's at the heart of this, George. It's right at the very heart of this, because with this space frame chassis, it gives the FIA the ability to say, there, that is the safety cell that we've worked on. We know that's the safest way to go rally. Take that safety cell, put it into your tubular chassis, and away you go. Yeah. That's, you know,
car bounces down the road, shedding all its fiberglass components, and going down through the spears that are trees, I'd still rather have a bit of tin around me, I'll be honest with you, and a nice steel bulkhead in front of me. Mm. You know, I mean, for all the safety that we have in World Rally Cars, and here's a point, here's a slightly controversial point. For all the safety we have in cars, the drivers sit on a thin carbon fibre seat on top of a thin floor with very little protection from underneath. Point's been raised dozens of times. Why aren't they sitting on at least, you know, 30 or 40 millimetres of aluminium sandwich plate, you know, zone. But they're not. Simple thing. So honestly, all the safety, I'm still not buying into it. Give me a steel bulkhead, steel floor, a thicker steel floor than currently exists, and a roof that doesn't come off. You know, your face would be wiped off with going down through trees if there wasn't a thin steel roof on the car. You know, I'm not obviously it's not going to stop everything, but getting your face wiped off with a whole load of branches going down through the trees, not a pretty thing. No, I'm not into the space frame car. Sorry.
No, but equally, you know, we saw a whole load of Group B cars. Ari Vatanen in Argentina in 85. You know, the car disintegrated, but there was still a roof on it when it stopped.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, absolutely. I'm not sure. Did that still have a steel roof? That car. Some of them did have some steel parts.
Yeah, I think it did.
Yeah. So point made. Perhaps the Toyota, the last of the Toyota Group S cars, that prototypes, they actually still had a steel bulkhead, believe it or not, and a steel roof on them.
I think there's compromise there, George. That there is, and I'm sure you know the FA, their safety department, their technical department, will have looked into this far more deeply than we will. And you know, I totally see your perspective with the Rally 2 car, but to me it's not ideally that it's not the way we're going. You know,
quite clearly it's not, you know, we'll absolutely respect. And I mean, you know, in fairness to FIA, current World Rally car rules, they've been fabulous. They've given us a great car.
They've given us an unsustainable car, George.
An unsustainable car. So let's go back one more step. I think the best formula that FIA have ever come up with, and they've come up with a lot of good ones. Group N and Group A were great. That was the fallback when Group B stopped. We just went straight back into Group A, and it was allowed to develop correctly and intelligently for the most part. It had its ups and downs. Group N was an absolutely bog-standard car in 86, 87, but it became a much better car by the time it, 2008, 2009, we started to see the S2000s coming in. But that was then, you know, it was recognised not to be perfect, the S2000. FIA came up with our R5 car, which has been an unbelievable success.
Yeah,
it has.
Very, very well cost controlled, lovely, good, strong, safe car. And I think it's promoted our sport very, very well. And it's given drivers opportunities.
It has. And it's taken the sport around the world. But also, fundamentally, you know, the whole idea of the 2017 car, for me, the mass appeal of it was flawed when the FIA said, understandably, back at the end of 16, we will only sanction certain drivers to drive this car. You know, that. Mm-hmm. Destroyed the market for the privateer. You know, they were terrified of these cars.
No, I don't think
cars.
That did, David.
Of course it did, Colin. Go and ask Malcolm Wilson how many he sold.
Did, Colin. Absolutely, Colin.
How many people were told, no, you can't drive that car?
In 17, pretty much everybody.
Seriously? I didn't know that.
Of course they were.
The cost of it as well, Colin.
The cost, that's my point, it was the cost.
They drove the cost up, which is exactly the point we're making right now.
That's entirely my point. You know, drivers like Mads Osberg, drivers like Martin Prokop, the 2017 car.
It's not them. It's not them that this is aimed at, Col. It's aimed at the people, the really very well-heeled gentleman drivers who can afford €1 million, €2 million rally car. They were the ones that were told, no, you're not coming in 17.
I'm not sure many were actually barred from driving the car. I've seen drivers in those new generation World Rally cars who I've never heard of, who are in their 60s.
How many did you see in 2017, Col?
In 2017 cars I'm talking about.
No, but in 2017, the year, the season, how many did you see then?
I don't... Have they relaxed the rule since then? Has the rule changed?
Yeah, okay. They have. Then, absolutely. Fair enough. The rule hasn't changed, essentially, but what's happened since Yves Matton arrived is that he's taken a more lenient approach. You know, still, if you want to drive that car, Col, you have to go knock on Mr. Maton's door and say, will you let me? And he's more likely, okay, not you, because he's probably seen you drive. He's more than likely going to say yes. You know, we saw that guy in Monty this year. His name escapes me again.
And we saw the Czech driver last year doing a couple of events, or the year before. Can't remember his name.
And this, you know, brings you back to that original argument. You know, who is more dangerous? And this is something I think we've discussed before. You know, is the more dangerous driver someone like Gus Greensmith, who is a driver that's, you know, he's on the up and up and he's coming and he's got great potential. He's going to go to Monty in a World car this year for the first time. He went there for the first time, pushing like hell to try to demonstrate what he can do. Is he more dangerous than your man in his late 50s who just wants to achieve a dream and you know, perform the rallying equivalent of Wimbledon?
Has to pay to fix his own car.
With the same bit of kit, go and compete against Teemu Suninen.
I see the arguments, but I don't think they're relevant. The relevance of those cars are giving drivers opportunities, and the question of safety of the older gentleman driver driving carefully, or as you say, the Gus Greensmith driving fast. I think it's neither here nor there. We're driving rally cars in an incredible environment. I mean, it shouldn't be as safe as it is, but there we are. It is.
I think it just comes down to cost, David. I don't get this argument either.
100%, Colin. 100%.
I think it's come down to cost, you know? Yeah. Whereas you, when you have drivers who are richer than you and I can possibly imagine turning around and saying it's too expensive for me, then we have a problem, because this sport has always been at the top level about... a word the FIA used that I don't like, but pro-am. It's always been about the professionals and the amateurs. Now,
Then tell me, who are the Group B amateur drivers that were
David,
right at the
it's had its moments. It's 2017 was one of those moments. It's had its moments, but
Santos that crashed in Portugal.
Yeah,
exactly. He was a pro-am.
But it's had its moments. But the inherently, this sport has been about the fact that people can have their Wimbledons, they can have their Opens at St Andrews, they can have their Formula Ones through the streets of Monte Carlo as rally drivers. It has always been about that, and it's been one of the real unique selling points of this sport. It's what's made it interesting over the years, it's what's made it endearing over the years. We are trying, through I think some almost unilateral views, to change that concept.
Do you know what,
I'm
Colin?
I'm not sure it's right.
Do you know what, Colin? I agree 100%. I was trying to formulate an argument in my mind about using Rally 2 cars for general, but actually you're right.
But that's what the FIA want, and it's only certain people in the FIA, as I can see it, that want that. And I don't really know where that view has come from. I don't know how it's been allowed to go unchallenged, because it does affect, I think, the long-term sustainability of the sport. This sport has been propped up by privateers over the years. The championship has been propped up by our friends in the Middle East, in South America, in Australia, who come and support our championship in top-level cars. They are now being told it's not for you. The top level is for manufacturers. And someone has made that decision, and it has gone unchallenged. And I think it's dangerous for the long-term future of the sport.
We're almost out of time, David, just to warn you.
All right, but just beyond that, Col, as well, and to strengthen your point about the cost of these cars, you know, you look at, in the years gone by, the chance of the championship going around the world, it goes to Wales, to Rally GB, and you have the ability for someone like Mark Higgins to put a budget together to fight in a car that is just the same. And he did in 2001 or two.
Yeah.
And
that's 20 years ago.
You know, yeah, but it doesn't matter, Lisa.
We don't have to go back 20 years. You don't have to go back to Australia.
We just have to go back to achievable economics for private drivers to come in, because that's, as well as the gentleman drivers and the privateers, the local flavour going to Australia and New Zealand and having Possum Born there and these kind of guys, and, you know, going across to Argentina and seeing Jorge Recalde and these kind of, perhaps that's a bad example, but
that's a good example.
Ability for those people to bring local flavour, it spreads the word of the sport as well,
100%.
Because a local hero is far more of interest than the likes of Sebastian Ogier or Ott Tänak.
And what's happened, David, is we have allowed this policy to go unchallenged, and it's been the last 12 months or so, and it was slowly introduced, quietly introduced. No one has challenged it.
For me, the fundamental part was in 17 when they said you have to pass an FIA test to drive this car.
You add that to the fact that they're now saying that Rally 1 cars are purely for manufacturers, and that is a sea change in how our sport presents itself. It is a sea change, and it's dangerous, and it's gone unchallenged, and I think the debate has to be had.
And you can continue this debate with us on Twitter, I think, is perhaps the way we can end this. At Dirtfish Rally, let us know what you think, because we nearly got very close there to all of you agreeing You even agreed with Colin there, David. I don't know if you realise that came out of your mouth.
But, yeah, no, it's not going to happen again, Lise.
But this is going to rage, this debate. And if you want to be part of it, at Dirtfish Rally on Twitter is perhaps one of the best ways to join in with the team. Well, I have to say that has been... I've just sat back and listened to most of that because I found that really, really interesting this time round. George Donaldson, Colin Clark, David Evans, thank you as always for your insightful, intelligent conversation.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Lise.
Thank you, Lise.
The debate may continue to rage, but I'm just simply outraged at the moment. There we go.
Can you tell? I got a little bit heated there. I'm very sorry.
You are an angry man at the moment, aren't you?
Not really, no. Passionate. Passionate.
Yeah, passionate's good.
We'll be back with another episode of Spin the Rally Pod next week. And if you haven't already, then can I suggest you subscribe using your very favourite podcast provider?